Okay, any preliminary questions? I have a series of sort of housekeeping issues. The Q&A, which we haven't had for a couple of weeks here, will be today, room 226, for those of you interested. I also agreed to have to allow the Lewis and Clark High School something or other class, I'm assuming it's about 25 students, to sit in on this class. With all the empty seats here, is there anybody that would be willing to move to the 1 o'clock section just for tomorrow? It's just tomorrow. So to attend this class, I promise to cover the same material. I don't want too many people to move there, because then we'll have the opposite problem over there. So why don't the number of people, obviously, if something goes kablooey, you're not obligated to do this, but if you have a rough, I would like about 15 or 20 volunteers if you're willing to come at 1 rather than at 11. So who would be willing to do that? I thought I saw some hands there. Okay, I'll take all those volunteers. And then tomorrow, I think we, with those folks shifting, we'll have room here. I appreciate your flexibility. We all try to accommodate here. Okay, any housekeeping issues on your end? I have one more thing I wanted to talk about. Over the weekend, I saw something on TVW. I don't know how many of you get cable, Channel 5, the C-SPAN, the state version of C-SPAN. So your public affairs broadcasting. They periodically run Supreme Court cases, and over the weekend they had a case that was argued last week. It might have been Monday or Tuesday that it was argued of last week. The case name is Philippides. I just was on the phone this morning with Brian Harnato, who was one of the advocates. I think he got 8 minutes for the American Trial Lawyers Association. He is one of our adjuncts. He teaches trial advocacy, and he also appellate advocacy and state constitutional law. Another advocate was Phil Talmadge, a former Washington Supreme Court justice, as well as candidate for governor. It was an extended argument period because it actually consolidated 4 different cases, and the issue the court was wrestling with was the interpretation of Washington's wrongful death statute. In particular, whether or not the provision that permitted parents to recover for the death or injury to their children, in particular, the death of a child, extended beyond those on whom the parents were economically dependent. So the statute reads something like, you know, the death of a child before the age of majority, or in effect beyond the age of majority, if the parents are dependent upon the children for support. And several parents had filed wrongful death claims of adult children upon whom they were dependent for support in varying degrees, both economically as well as emotionally. And in these 4 consolidated cases, the court was trying to find a rule that said they either did or did not qualify. And I'm going to try to identify when they rebroadcast this argument, so that those of you who could tape it, I would highly recommend that you tape it and at your leisure watch it. It's really not only very apropos to the questions we're wrestling with now, but to watch some very interesting exchanges between the bench and the lawyers on how to interpret statutes, how to deal with this whole Moraine versus States Marine Lines issue about whether the common law continues to essentially provide no remedy for wrongful death, that this has all been preempted by the legislature, whether that presumption should continue, and whether there is a distinction that the courts have to recognize between economic and non-economic support, what sort of relationships count, and all sorts of stuff like that. So, again, I'll try to get more information. I'm trying to get a copy of the briefs that were filed so I can put them online. You can look at them. Again, it will give you a very good picture of the way in which the issues that we're looking at here are as current as today's headlines, essentially. I asked Brian what he thought the outcome of the case would be, and he said, I haven't the foggiest idea. They appear to be very conflicted on this point. The court doesn't want to boldly go off into creating new causes of action, expanding beneficiaries. At the same time, the court doesn't want to adopt arbitrary limits that would result in some cases providing a remedy, but cases that by any measure would have a greater appeal or would seem more deserving of recovery, that those would be artificially put aside. So again, this question about where's the line to be drawn very much in play. We're transitioning today from, we've been doing all these wrongful birth cases, wrongful life cases, and we just before that we did the wrongful death cases. We're going to transition today into the questions about bystander injuries, loss of consortium. As I said on Wednesday, I want to spend just a few minutes on Taylor versus Caropity. I would have... as I said before, I would have liked to edit this so you didn't have so much to slog through. By the same token, I think it gives you a good feel for the kinds of passions that cases like this raise and the extent to which courts and legislatures in deciding where to draw the line will not only reference tort doctrines that provide parallel kinds of principles, but the question about whether and how to recognize these kinds of causes of action will stir questions about, well, wait a minute, is this any business of the tort system? What sort of public policy implications are there when we venture into this area? While I'm sort of on that subject, I might say there is a principle in medicine called iatrogenesis. That is the idea that the treatment itself causes harm. The cure is worse than the disease. So one of the things that you try to avoid in medicine is iatrogenic results. If you're treating some condition like tonsillitis, to the extent that tonsillectomies as a routine basis periodically have complications and lead to death or serious injury, you say, wait a minute, is the cure worse than the disease? Other kinds of routine procedures, routine prescription of antibiotics and the like. So similarly, I would say in law, we have this question of whether or not at certain points the quest for justice becomes, by a parallel way, iatrogenic, in that the search for the perfect remedy winds up effectively causing more harm than good. And again, this is as you look at the discovery rules in civil procedure, as you look at the rules we adopt for the interpretation of contracts or for property law doctrines or constitutional law, for that matter. to what extent in your quest to find the most perfect system do you wind up doing things, making the system, in effect, become the enemy rather than your friend. So, again, I've sort of been rambling here for a moment. Any questions or issues about the wrongful birth, wrongful life line of cases that I could help clear up or illuminate? Let me before I do that, let me just summarize what the law is on this point so you have a clear idea. Again, the kind of policy, jurisprudential, philosophical issues we can't really resolve. They're a matter for you to ponder. But with respect to what the law is, I can state that fairly clearly. Again, with respect to wrongful birth, these are claims brought by the parents. And again, you want to clearly identify, is this a wrongful birth case? Was the effect of the defendant's negligence to cause the birth of a child? If so, it's a wrongful birth case. If the child was going to be born anyway, and what the doctor did was to cause injury to this child, then it's not a wrongful birth case. So, again, squeezing too hard on the forceps, not keeping an eye on the fetal heart monitor, if that results in the child suffering brain damage or some kind of injury, it's not a wrongful birth case. Where, however, the defendant fails to supply the proper prescription or produces a product that fails to act as a contraceptive or, there's some other sterilization procedure isn't done correctly. Where, again, the result of the defendant's negligence is a child is born that the parents say, this is a wrong to us, then the courts have a policy dilemma. Okay, with respect to healthy children, you essentially have a split of jurisdictions. Some say, as the Arizona Health Sciences Center case did, this is a case where the parents should recover the difference between the detriment they suffered by having a child they planned not to have, to whom they entrusted or in whom they entrusted the defendant. I'm getting my prepositions mixed up here, but again, where they trusted the defendants to help them avoid this and the defendant negligently failed to do so. Some say, fine, get your damages minus whatever offsetting benefit you receive from the birth of this child. Other jurisdictions, like Washington, as I think I may have mentioned, in the case of a healthy child would say, no, the parents are entitled to the childbirth expenses, loss of income during pregnancy, the cost of the procedure for childbirth, but that's it. The birth of the child, the life of the child, is as a matter of law not considered damage to the parents. Again, this is where the child is born healthy. So the jurisdictions are about evenly split on that point. However, with respect to a disabled child, then it's not entirely clear what qualifies as a disability. So thinking about the Harbison case where a child is born with cleft palate or, you know, some other condition that is not as serious as, fetal height antoin syndrome or some other significant disability, but assuming we have something that is like the fetal height antoin syndrome, in those cases, most courts will follow the Harbison rule of saying, again, damages minus offsetting benefit. With respect to wrongful life, again, this is the more controversial of the two causes of action. Some jurisdictions will recognize an additional claim by the child, but only for one who is disabled in some respect. so, again, it doesn't apply to a child who's born healthy. That child can't claim, I never should have been born. But as the Harbison Court did, some jurisdictions will say, in addition to the parent's claim for wrongful birth, the child also has legal standing to pursue a claim for wrongful life. Again, some jurisdictions, either by statute or by court decision, will say we want no part of this, but some will say this is no different from other kinds of tort claims. We just have to do the best we can to measure the damages in a reasonably fair way. Does that help clarify what the law is here so we can move on? Yeah. Oh, with respect to the wrong, yeah. With respect, again, the Harbison case is typical of saying that in a wrongful life claim, it is for economic damages after maturity. I don't know of any court that has recognized a claim beyond what the Harbison Court recognized in terms of saying the child can recover for the difference between being born in a disabled condition and not being born at all. As the court said in Harbison, how would one begin to compare that apple and that orange? Therefore, we're going to confine the damages in a wrongful life claim to the economic loss suffered by the child after maturity when the parents are no longer obligated to provide support. Yes, because that's the and again, you would have the the economic obligation for the parents lasts until maturity. Presumably, I hadn't really thought about this, the question of whether the non-economic damage would be claimed beyond that. Again, though, these things are fairly difficult to try to. If you imagine, for example, in the Arizona Health Sciences Center case, where the parents are saying, we want a recovery, although the child is healthy, we want a recovery for the difference between our quality of life with three children, which is what we planned, and life with four children, which is what the defendant's negligence stuck us with, there wouldn't be any particular reason why you would stop the non-economic losses from accumulating after the children reach the age of majority. But again, this is the point at which it gets difficult to quantify. Okay? Well, with that, I'd like to begin with Dillon versus Legg, because Dillon versus Legg raises the whole issue of what to do with non-economic relationship kinds of injuries that people suffer when they either watch someone whom they love suffer some injury, or even if it happens while they're not there, the relative says, in effect, as I said earlier, Marianne Rodriguez says to us, you dropped a 600-pound pipe, not just on my husband, but since we are, so to speak, one flesh here, this is my issue as well. You have to compensate me. So again, the whole question, as I said earlier in this Philippides case that the court is wrestling with, how do we define the limits of a defendant's obligation to compensate? So let's start with Dillon versus Legg and just put the facts of the case and the constellation here on the map. Yes. What's that? Yeah. Okay, so we imagine that the mom's standing on the porch, watching this scene unfold to her horror. She sees the defendant strike her daughter, while the daughter and her sister were crossing the street. Daughter's killed. The other daughter, the sister to the decedent here, is physically untouched, but obviously traumatized by having her sister killed in the crosswalk. Okay, so we, as we often do in these cases, we kind of do a little bit of history here of where we've come from in terms of the law of California. And once upon a time in California, we had a rule that said you couldn't recover unless... Okay, actually, before that, it wasn't even enough to be in the zone of danger. Yes, the first rule before this Amaya case, Amaya versus Home Ice, prior to that, the rule was essentially there had to be a touching of some kind. Unless you were physically touched, even though you were physically unhurt, you couldn't recover. Now, before we go any further, I want to make sure we've identified why this case is different from the lady on the train who gets, you know, physically, she's physically touched, traumatized, but we tell her, sorry, lady, there's nothing here for you. Why is this case different? Both factually, and why that factual difference makes a difference in terms of the outcome. Let's talk about the sister first. Why does the sister get to recover from being there when her sister gets killed, but the lady on the train gets nothing? Okay, but factually, what's different between this and the case on the train? In the train, she actually does get touched, and we still say, sorry, lady, forget about it. Ms. Schmidt? Okay, but what's factually different here? Somebody got killed here, okay? This is what I would call a derivative case rather than a sort of primary case. So the lady on the train, we say to her, or the mix-up about the lab samples in the Kaiser permanent group health case, whatever that was, where the injury is directly to the plaintiff. There's no physical injury to anybody. It's mere emotional injury. We say, in effect, most of those cases go away, unless you can prove some kind of guarantee of genuineness, some kind of super threshold. Mere emotional injury where nobody gets physically hurt is uncompensable. This case is different because somebody got a whole lot of physically hurt. We're already making the defendant pay significantly. What we now have to say is how many people, in addition to that immediate victim, does the defendant have to compensate? Again, I would refer to these as derivative claims. They owe their existence to somebody else's injury. And in one sense, it may incline us to say, well, okay, if the defendant's already being forced to compensate here, it's not that big of a stretch to add somebody to the guest list, so to speak. The defendant's already sort of throwing a party here. We're just, you know, saying we'll set a few more places at the table. As opposed to saying, I think we can do without any kind of recovery here at all. Okay, so that's the first distinction. And now we go back to these rules which say, prior to Amaya versus Home Ice, the rule was you had to be physically touched. As of Amaya versus Home Ice, the court says, what? Okay, and that would mean that the sister clearly falls within that rule, but now the mom is knocking on the door saying, what about me? And the answer that was given in Maya versus Home Ice is, in effect, you're not in the zone of danger. Well, what does zone of danger have to do with it? Why do we care about whether you're in the zone of danger? Why did Cardozo care about the zone of danger? Because you're not foreseeable. If the plaintiff is outside... The reason the sister, and you may have said this earlier here, the reason the sister qualifies is because, well, of course, if she's in within this zone of danger, you could easily foresee an injury to her. Therefore, the defendant owed her a duty. Therefore, the defendant's on the hook. In this case, however, the defendant says, I could not foresee someone outside the zone of danger, therefore I didn't owe them a duty, therefore she's not eligible for any compensation. Now again, I've already used this before, but when the defendant in this case argues, I didn't owe the plaintiff a duty, the court's answer to that is duty schmooty. You know, what are you doing with that label there? You're using that label as to sort of short circuit your thinking process. The real question the court says that we should be asking is, does this individual deserve to be compensated for being a witness to her daughter's negligently caused death? Let's decide that question straight up, says the court. When we're done with answering that question, then we'll tell you whether they owed her a duty. Otherwise, you got the wrong end of the telescope here. You're assuming that duty's going to do some kind of work for you, and in fact, duty, as they say, is a shorthand label to explain something that is a public policy question that we will answer as we see fit. Again, this is on page 88 on the right-hand column. The court adopts this language from Prosser, Saint Prosser, to all of us, this is the way the tort system works. Now, I think Judge Cardozo would have a problem with this, because I think Judge Cardozo was more of the opinion that duty was a meaningful question to ask. It wasn't just a label that courts slapped on something when they thought it was good public policy to hold the defendant liable. Cardozo thought that duty, in effect, had a kind of life of its own. You could follow the duty question to its logical conclusion. The tort system should be an answer to breaches of duty rather than the tort system, in effect, creating duties by saying, oh, we think this person ought to compensate that person. So again, one of the things that makes Dillon versus Legg interesting is that we have the California court adopting a kind of philosophical position here to say, in effect, don't give us this duty stuff.
Talk to the hand, because the, you know, whatever that is, you know, we're not buying this.
Now again, the part of the philosophical question is, should the court take a more I don't know how to describe it. Should the court take a position that assumes that the duty question has an independent life of its own? Maybe, maybe not. Okay, now, the court is essentially saying, let's start this question from the ground up. What does the court think is relevant to determining whether or not a recovery should be permitted by the mother of the, from the defendant? And look, right after saying, in effect, don't give us this duty stuff, the court takes as its lodestar, its guiding light here, the very criterion foreseeability that Cardozo thought was the beginning of the duty question. So just as Andrews, in effect, rejected Cardozo, but then, you know, looked at a lot of the same factors in deciding whether to impose liability, so the California court pushes this duty thing out the front door, but kind of motions it back in through the back door. Same kind of analysis, it's just done in a different way. Okay, so the question before the court is it reasonably foreseeable to this defendant, again, driving down the street, could I reasonably foresee that my negligence could result not only in an injury to someone, I'm reaching around to get my sunglasses, I don't see that this girl is trying to cross the street, she thinks she's in a crosswalk, that she's safe, I don't even know she's there, by the time I look around, she's too close, I can't stop, I run over her, she dies. The question is it reasonably foreseeable that in driving down the street, I could foresee not only that I would injure somebody on the highway, but that a close relative, her mother, might be a witness to this, that the mother would suffer emotional trauma from that event, and that I then am obligated to compensate. Okay, the court asks that question. It doesn't simply answer it yes or no. It says, well, let's think about it for a second. And how does the court want us to think about it? Okay, and those factors are... What do you mean the location? Okay, and in particular, it's not just the distance, but in effect their presence at the accident scene. So if somebody got run over in the lobby out here,
I might be actually physically, you know, so many yards away from that scene, but I'm not present at the accident scene because I'm here in here teaching my class. Somebody over there gets burned by the espresso machine or what have you. Whereas someone else actually witnesses it, is present at the accident scene, they're there at the scene. So again, the mom is at the scene of the accident because she can see it all going on. Suppose dad is in the backyard mowing the lawn. He's got, you know, his MP3 player on, or he's got, you know, his earplugs in. He can't hear anything over the whine of the lawnmower until suddenly, you know, people are come running and screaming, saying, come here, come quickly. He's in a different position according to criterion number one. He may be physically close to it, but he's not present at the accident scene. Okay? So it's presence at the accident scene that is criterion number one. What's criterion number two? Okay, so what the court is trying to distinguish here is the distinction between what happens to the mother watching her daughter get killed, and just to clarify it, what happens if dad is at the office? Frantic call to dad at the office. Something horrible's happened, you got to come quickly. He gets there 10 minutes later just as the ambulance is leaving, or he meets him at the hospital, what have you. If you know that family and you know, you're hearing what happens, and the dad explains, yeah, they, you know, this guy ran over my daughter, we got her to the hospital, it was too late and she died. You say, well, whew, at least you didn't see it. We're trying to distinguish here, at least, the direct emotional shock, the post-traumatic stress disorder, from the father's grief at losing his daughter. Grief is the same in either case. The mother's grief, if she'd been shopping at the store or doing something else, and she doesn't actually see it, well, mom's going to, you know, this is the worst day of her life. But that's not what we're compensating here. Whatever mom's loss is from the loss of her daughter, whatever dad's loss is from the loss of his daughter, that gets compensated through the wrongful death side of things. What we're trying to compensate for here are these so-called bystander claims. I was there, you ran over my daughter, I have this post-traumatic stress disorder. Over and over again in my mind, I keep reliving this, these intrusive memories. And so PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is a recognized, you know, phenomenon, psychological kind of harm, various kinds of treatments for it. That's what we're trying to identify here. So presence at the accident scene, direct emotional shock, and what's the third question? Okay, now in this case we have a very strong, I mean, you can hardly imagine state the a relationship more important than that of mother and child. I mean, you can argue there are different kinds of relationships. There's the husband-wife relationship in Rodriguez. They're different. You don't necessarily want to rank these things, except you kind of do. I mean, what the court is saying is, suppose mom is standing right next to her mother, grandma. Grandma lives with them. Grandma's had a very important role in the daughter's growth and development. You know, grandparents and grandchildren are united by having a common enemy. as they say. And, you know, there, suppose there's a very close relationship here. Does Grandma get to recover? What about Aunt Susan? What about, you know, again, we inevitably start this sort of slippery slope or the floodgates argument, but the court says the nature of the relationship, if the plaintiff wants to recover, it's got to be a close relationship. Not just any relationship will do. Again, we encounter the same problems that we had in the wrongful death cases. What about the fiancé? What about the what about other kinds of relationships where you don't have a category for it? How are you going to account for the difference? Some parents and children are extremely close. Some parents and children are extremely estranged. Does that matter? Or do you simply, again, as I said earlier about this Filippides case, where the court's trying to figure out, how do we draw the line? Now, again, what's different in these cases compared to the wrongful death cases is we don't have a statute that we answer to. Here the court is developing a common law where the legislature has not yet spoken to say, do this, don't do that. The limiting feature for the court is we want a reasonably coherent body of law. And again, one of the arguments in the Filippides case about in effect expanding the beneficiaries to include not only those parents who were economically dependent upon their children for support, but those who were emotionally dependent upon their children for support. The defendant argued one of the reasons you shouldn't expand it is because suppose a 25-year-old who's got a husband and children, she's killed, and along comes the mother who says, I was emotionally dependent upon my daughter. I want part of the pie here. By allowing the mother's claim to be added to the list of eligible beneficiaries of this wrongful death claim, do you weaken, do you shrink the pie available to the husband and the children of the decedent? As a public policy matter, for the sake of the real plaintiffs, do you want to expand to these Johnny-come-latelys, so to speak? So again, the public policy question for the court is, as you have the victim, and then a sort of, in Andrew's terms, in Paul's graph, these sort of like dropping a pebble in a pond, and you have these ripples extending outward. Not only are you concerned about the point at which, gee, the first cousin once removed pen pal from the third grade, not only are we out someplace where I don't think this person really deserves to be compensated, but even those who are closer into the center wind up in competition with one another. Because in many cases you will have limited assets of the defendant, and how do we decide which of these gets to line up to claim a share of the defendant's limited assets for compensation? So the court says we consider these factors in deciding whether or not we ought to compensate a victim who claims to be a bystander and suffering from the defendant's negligence. Does the mother in this case qualify? Yeah, she gets an A on each of these. Like trying to figure out what's an abnormally dangerous activity, it's not so much that you qualify or don't qualify. It is we sort of roll these things around in deciding what to do. So, for example, at some point here, I think I make reference to the Ballinger case on page 91, left-hand column in the notes, middle of note number 3. Ballinger versus Ariel Tramway. These two people meet. If you go skiing by yourself, which I do from time to time because my kids don't want to keep slowing down for their old man. So I'm out there, you know, and you get on the chairlift with somebody and you have a 3-minute conversation and you get off the chairlift. These two people get on the chairlift, or this gondola or whatever it is, but instead of, you know, parting, there's this accident, and one of the passengers is gored, in effect, by the mechanism, and it takes a while until help arrives. The person, not physically hurt, but who says, I suffered post-traumatic stress disorder, wants a recovery. Under Dillon versus Legg, would they qualify? Yeah, this one doesn't look good for them, but the court said, oh, that's okay. You're so good, you know, you get an A on one, you get an A on two, you get a D on number 3 here. Well, you actually did have this kind of bonding experience if you watch Rescue 911 or something else. You know, these people who get to know each other through some, here I am stuck on this thing, someone's horribly injured, I'm, you know, applying CPR or first aid, applying a tourniquet, whatever it is I'm doing to try to rescue this person. Well, that becomes, you know, this lifelong bond. The court says it's for the jury. They get to decide how much to compensate the person who was there when this gruesome thing took place, stuck together in this gondola. Yeah. Well, this was the case in the Washington Supreme Court, which gets referenced in Hagel versus McMahon, which we'll do next. The case of Gain versus Carroll Mill. This is on page 92 in the right-hand column. The plaintiffs are the dad and the brother of a state trooper. They watch on TV. They don't actually watch their son or brother, as the case might be, get killed. But they see the live TV shot of this state trooper's car. They recognize the license plate, and they're talking about a dead state trooper. They say, we were virtually there. The court said, nah, you weren't there. But again, the court is, the reason we start with Dillon versus Legg, and we'll pick this up tomorrow, is because Dillon versus Legg sets the table, in effect. It's not so much that everybody bows down and worships Dillon versus Legg, but as Hagel versus McMahon demonstrates, it's often the starting point for saying, here are the issues, let's talk about them. Which of these is more important? How are we going to, again, convert this into a test that a trial judge can use to be a gatekeeper, to say, okay, I'll let you through, you're not eligible. Stay away. So the court's got to figure out how do you set the criteria by which the trial judge lets some people state their claim to the jury and some don't, and we'll pick that up tomorrow. Don't forget, those of you who volunteered to come at one, to come at one. Thanks.